thank you for joining the WHO telecast with Professor Seeto. My name is Phil Russo from the National Hand Hygiene Initiative in Australia, and I've been asked to host this session. So thank you for joining. Just a quick bio on Professor Seeto. As you may well know, he's played a key role in initiating infection control in Hong Kong and started the training courses for infection control practitioners in 1985. He's involved extensively in infection control throughout China and the region and is the founding president of the Asia Pacific Society of Infection Control. Besides being honorary professor for the University of Hong Kong and Hong Kong Polytechnic University, he's also the visiting professor for the University of New South Wales in Australia. WHO has also regularly assigned him as advisor for various projects in infection control, antibiotics resistance, and he's a core member of the WHO hand hygiene guideline. He's also a member of the emergency committee of the IHR at WHO, member of the Infection Control International Network, and director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Infection Control in Hong Kong. He has authored over 100 research papers and is frequently invited to present at international conferences, including Hospital Infection Society, APIC, and SHE. So I'm sure you will all join me in welcoming Professor Seeto for this teleclass.
Okay, thank you. Well, welcome to the session. And, you know, this series of lectures is broadcast all over the world. And firstly, to get all of us who are infection control together, we are really a community struggling with the same problems because bacteria and mode of spread actually is the same all over the world. And then, of course, there are other of our colleagues who will need to be involved. And so I'm sure some of them are listening in, so welcome to all of you. Many of our friends in Hong Kong are listening in, so I'm sure some of these things that we talk about is already been practiced. Perhaps we can clarify some of the reasoning clearer during this session. Now, we have roughly an hour. There are many slides, so keep those slides in front of you. And because of the nature of the presentation, we can't move forward and backward on the slides. So I will be talking about the slide numbers. So as you go through the slides, do keep those numbers in mind, as I will be using it as it is printed on the website. All right? So shall we begin? Okay? Now, as I said, there is, in the slides here, there is the problem of overreaction. In Hong Kong, we have, as you know, the first city outbreak of avian flu way back, 97, then SARS. So often in Hong Kong, we are sort of very alert, and sometimes we overreact. And as in slide 3, of course, these are just cartoons. I'll show you two cartoons to make it lighter so that we can go into the talk with a lighter heart. Although it's a cartoon, you know, but sometimes you really see our public almost practicing this, using her toes to press the leaf. They're so scared. And, of course, the next slide in slide 4 is Noah's, the famous Old Testament figure, Noah himself. And this is a cartoon, of course. He put all the birds into a raft and says, when they sneeze, just cut the rope. Sometimes, you know, if you come to Hong Kong, in our hospitals, and you sneeze, everybody looks at you. You almost feel the same way. Now, but today, we're going to go through some important guidelines, many of these produced by WHO, and hopefully we are able to explain some of the rationale behind it. Slide 5. There are many guidelines produced and many documents, but the one that we will be referring today is this one in slide 6. Now, it's very simple. It's called Infection Prevention and Control of Epidemic and Pandemic-Prone Acute Respiratory Disease in Healthcare. Well, this guideline actually is produced right after SARS because there are many in the world who really want some guidance. As you know, patients come to our hospitals and come to our healthcare facilities with not having the diagnosis confirmed. They just have what we call influenza-like illness, or ILI. So what can we do? Now, hopefully this document, which was produced in 2007, after much work, in fact, we spent many months reviewing all the data and literature, and then wrote this little booklet such that it is evidence-based, but also taking into consideration practical problems like lack of space and so on and so on. Now, so go to it. And in fact, you can download this in slide number 7. We give you the website. Please download it. And in fact, I was told that this is one of the most frequently downloaded documents in the WHO website. So you can help us to keep that reputation up. Go in and get it. And if you can't find it, maybe there's some change of the website address. Just do a search and you will get it because it's very frequently downloaded. Now, I just also want to tell you that when the pandemic occurred in 2009, the H1N1 pandemic, for the first time, the WHO was able to respond very quickly. In fact, the moment it was upgraded to phase 6, almost on the same day or the day after, the WHO was able to come out with a clear guideline. And this is in page 8. And one big reason why this was possible was because the ARD guideline, as the document I show you in slide 7, was always already ready. And it was much easier to reach consensus and to quickly produce the guideline that can be used for the world. So do download the guideline, and today we'll be talking about it. Now, in slide 9 is the content, so I won't go into it. Please study the document clearly. I think many of it is self-explanatory. Now, my job today is basically to go through some of the key issues and hopefully to explain some problems. Now, how I wish this is not just a talk over the phone or the website, that I can see you face-to-face. And because many of these things are practical issues that can be best explained talking to one another. But nevertheless, in spite of this inadequacy, I will try my best. So keep, as I say, the slide in front of you and the numbers, because I will be referring to it. Now, number one, point number one, there are 10 points altogether, and hopefully we can get through it in this hour. Point number one, in that booklet, in slide 7, we talk clearly about standard precaution. Now, this is very important. You should get your hospital to practice standard precaution. And in slide 11, we basically explain what is standard precaution. Now, as you know, today in most hospitals, we practice what we call transmission-based precaution. The precaution we take is based on the mode of transmission of the various viral disease. So as you can see here, it can be airborne, droplets, contact, or bloodborne. And the precautions we take are general measures, such as hand hygiene, the well-known famous hand hygiene, good environmental hygiene, and specific measures, such as for airborne, we would recommend a negative pressure room and a respirator N95. I will go into all these later on. For this slide, just to emphasize that we have general measure and specific measures. Now, if you look at this chart again in slide 11, bloodborne, because bloodborne infections are often asymptomatic. And so that's how standard precaution actually come into being. We collected all the general measures together with the specific measure for bloodborne, because they are asymptomatic. So when a patient comes in with a bloodborne viral infection, we really don't know whether he is infected or not. So we assume that they are already infected. So collecting all the general measures of all these viral infection and the specific measure of the blood-borne infection, putting it all together, it forms standard precautions. Now, for standard precautions, what we do is we treat every patient the same way. And we assume that they already got a blood-borne infection. Doesn't mean they have, you know, it's just an assumption. And the point is standard. We used to call it universal precaution. That means we treat every patient the same way. Now, slide 12 actually is cut and paste from the CDC guidelines. We summarize all the measures for standard precaution. As you can see, we now include even things like environmental control and wearing the right PPE, and for soil equipment, it must be handled the right way. But one very important point, now under standard precaution, is we have included what we call cough etiquette. That means whenever a patient cough, they should cover their mouth with a tissue or should be wearing a surgical mask. Now, I have also included a little poster we make in Hong Kong. As you can see, it is in Chinese. And I'm sure in your own countries, you have things like this. But the point in slide 12 is that this is standard precaution, and now cough etiquette is solidly included under standard precautions. Standard precautions should be introduced in all your hospitals, and there should be measures taken irrespective of the diagnosis. Now we move on back to the 10 points. We come to point number 2. Now, this document in slide 7, I will for short call it the ARD document. In the ARD document, we basically deal with viral infections. And in fact, the next slide in slide 13 is the definition. We have ARD. And in the second bullet point, we list down the things that we want to deal with. We have included in the list all ARD with public impact. And there will be a table later on, table 1, that will include all these diseases. But let me point to those sub-bullet points here, which this document will cover. Yes, it covers SARS, obviously. In fact, SARS is the very disease that sparked off the production of this document. Then, obviously, we are concerned about the pandemic, so there is new influenza subtype. And in fact, this was prepared before H1N1. And so all the precautions against H1N1 was very much based on the document in slide number 7, the ARD document. Now, I'd like to mention the third bullet point. New organisms causing large-scale outbreaks and outbreak with high morbidity and mortality. Now, this is what we call a novel virus. We don't think it's going to be that frequent now, but obviously there will be new viruses that we don't know, like SARS previously. So the third bullet point here refers to a situation whereby you suddenly have a big cluster and you don't know the diagnosis yet. Now, usually it doesn't refer to just one patient, but you are seeing clusters emerging. And you have to make the judgment. If you're not sure, then put it under the novel virus cluster. Once there's a novel virus cluster, in this ARD document, we recommend that you deal with it as if it is airborne. And I will touch on it later on in other points. You will deal with it as if it's airborne. Now, there is one more bullet point which put plague. This ARD document will not discuss plague, even though it's important, mainly because in the WHO website, there are separate documents for plague. So we are only touching on the viral infections in this document, as I said, which include first bullet point SARS, the new influenza subtype, and the novel clusters, the novel virus clusters. Obviously, as I said, it will also touch on things like adenovirus, parainfluenza, which are ARD with public impact. So we have now sort of done with bullet point two, and we can move on. Now, we come to slide 15. Now, if you look at the ARD document, it goes through several main phases. And this is shown in figure 1, which we will see later on. Basically, in this flow chart in figure 1, we start with before the diagnosis is made. That means the patient comes with just ILI. The diagnosis is not made yet. What should you do? This is in figure 1. Then, later on, in point number 6, is after the diagnosis is made. So before the diagnosis is made, you look at figure 1. After the diagnosis is made, you look at table 1. Now, these are the only two figure and table in the ARD document. Figure 1 and table 1. So as I said, before diagnosis, figure 1. After diagnosis, table 1. Simple enough, right? Now, okay. So, before diagnosis is made, number 3. Now, before we move on, however, I need to really use this opportunity to clarify what is really airborne infection. Now, so as I said, as I put at the right-hand corner of this table, we must first understand correctly what is airborne infection. Now, it's quite important, you know, because in table 16, for instance, is an old textbook, 1985, way back. We used to think that every infection of the chest, every infection of the lung, because it makes us cough, and we cough into the air, right? Since we cough into the air, it must be airborne. So look at table 16, slide 16. Almost everything that can infect the lung used to be considered airborne. But now we know better. Because now we know that when you cough out particles, it must be small enough, in fact smaller than 3 micron, before it can float in the air for long distance. Now, this production of small size, less than 3 micron particles, we call it aerosol. So look at slide number 17. Now, in fact, I show you slide 17 to let you see how an aerosol looks like. It almost looks like smoke. This is where we need to clarify and help you to understand what exactly is airborne infection. Take a look at slide 18. On the left top corner is the normal lung, nice and clean. On the right bottom corner is pneumonia. Now, let me tell you, it's soaked with water. It's like mud. So now we know that when you get infected, your lung is soaked with water like mud. And when you cough, most of the particles, almost all, are not small. They are large particles. To help you understand, it's just like if you have a basin of water and you shake it, you don't see smoke coming out. You see large droplets like this, right, when you cough. And these droplets really don't travel that far. And right now we use 1 meter or 3 feet. It drops to the ground. Now, this is quite well established. And in fact, in a new systematic review to be announced and published by the WHO end of this year, which we will use to update the ARD document, it is again confirmed that 3 feet and 1 meter is the right concept. Now, I'm sure you and I know, we are all healthcare workers. When a patient coughs and they open their mouth, we don't see smoke coming out. We see droplets. So now, for practical purposes, there are only basically three lung infections that we will consider really airborne, meaning it travels for long distance. Pulmonary TB, chickenpox, and measles. All right? So these are the only three. Okay, now. So also want to show you that to further discuss this, we go to slide number 21. Now, so is influenza airborne? Well, there's some debate on it, but I think we are quite convinced now that it is not. In fact, if you want to be clear on the idea, just refer to the review by Branston, which is in slide 22. It's a very good review. It is by Branston et al. And in fact, the senior author is Michael Kadam, a very well-known epidemiologist. They have, in this review, over 2,000 citations. And basically, let me just very quickly review their conclusions. Now, slide 23. In fact, there are many studies done in the laboratory that seems to suggest it is airborne. But as pointed out by Branston et al., in many of these laboratory studies, the artificial aerosol produced, less than 10% are larger than 8 microns. But you should know that in natural coughing, 99% is larger than 8 microns. In other words, as I pointed out to you previously, when you cough naturally, especially when you have pneumonia, most of the particles you cough out are large. While in these laboratory studies, the aerosol they generate in these studies really are very small particles. So as correctly pointed out by Branston et al., as I quote in slide 21, we question whether these studies are relevant to the natural route of human transmission. Now, to further move on, in slide 24, one very famous study that sort of point and suggest that influenza could be airborne is this study which report an Alaskan airline that was sort of have to be grounded for 4 hours. All their passengers cannot leave the plane and their ventilation system is broken down and 72% got infected. So it was postulated that it must be airborne because how can so many people sitting in a plane get infected? But just to note that in this study, for the 4 hours, clearly there was also free movement of passengers. And also to show you that there's another study, as I quote here, that another plane was also grounded. And this time, the ventilation system is working very well. And it reports that there is also an outbreak involving 56%. So, in fact, it suggests that if you are in a plane for several hours, just because there is someone with influenza and it spread, it doesn't mean it's airborne. Now, also in this slide 24, we review other studies. As Branston et al. Review other studies, just to say that these studies are not valid because they did not really explain confounders. In these studies, the many things like the number of index patients, whether hand hygiene is practiced, is not dealt with. So it is considered not valid to accept the conclusion of these studies. Well, I will stop there. You have to study it more for yourself. Now, just to let you know that in slide 26 and 27, the WHO has also conducted a systematic review in 2008, looking up all the relevant literature. Now, just for your information, when the WHO conducts a systematic review, it's very thorough. And you can, in fact, go to the WHO website, and there is a document explaining this. Just search for it, and you will know it's very thorough. But in slide 26 and 27, we come to the same conclusion that, indeed, For airborne, it's only pulmonary TB, measles, and chickenpox. Now, in slide 27, we mentioned something called opportunistic airborne. As you can see, for opportunistic airborne, we have SARS and influenza. But for droplets, we also have SARS and influenza, but we include adenovirus and RSV. Now, so what is opportunistic airborne? So let me now explain, which is in slide 28. Now, in brief, when we say something is opportunistic airborne, we don't mean it is airborne. What we mean is it is only airborne if we do procedures that we call high-risk aerosol-generating procedures. Basically, it just means we intubate a patient or go into the respiratory system below the larynx. So as a result, the patient is now not coughing in a natural way. We have intervened into the lung such that it is closer to where the infected site is. And for such procedures, there is opportunity for aerosol production, even for diseases like SARS and influenza, that in the natural situation is not airborne. So look at slide 28 again. So obligate airborne, that means we say this is often, usually airborne, this is TB. We all know that. Preferential airborne is measles and chickenpox. And actually this is so mainly because for both of these diseases, they can have severe rashes. And sometimes they result in airborne. So we do consider this group, chickenpox and measles, also to be airborne. But for opportunistic airborne, they are not airborne unless you start doing what we call high-risk aerosol-producing procedures such as intubation. Now, there's so much rumor that SARS is airborne. Let me tell you, it is not. And for brevity, I will just refer you in slide 29 to a paper we wrote ourselves that shows quite categorically and clearly that in the hospital, SARS is not airborne. And if you practice droplets and contact precaution, you can successfully prevent it. Okay, now, for the next few slides, I'm going to talk about our recent pandemic. Because in the midst of 2009, there is a big debate whether influenza is airborne or not, H1N1. Now, of course, in the beginning, I suppose it's fair enough to say we are not sure because it's a new virus. But actually, very early in 2009, around about June, July, there's already quite clear consensus. Now, as you know, the WHO has always insisted that influenza is not airborne. It is just what we call opportunistic airborne, that is only when you do high-risk procedures. Now, take a look at slide 30. It basically summarizes around June, July, the debate and the conflicting sort of the different institutions and how they feel. Now, I put in this slide that both WHO and SHE, which is the Society of Healthcare Epidemiologists of America, plus HPAC, HICPAC. Now, this is the high-level committee, the CDC. They advise the CDC. And as you can see, basically there is consensus with all these groups and institutions that it is not airborne. And the N95, if you look at the last column, there are various columns, mask, glove, gowns, eye protection, the last column, N95. N95 is only needed for aerosol-generating procedures. Now take a look at slide 30 with the blue background. Now you look at slide 30 with the blue background, you will find that the CDC, together with the Institute of Medicine, however, feels that it might be airborne. And in fact, in the midst of the pandemic, both the CDC and the Institute of Medicine in America feels that it's airborne and recommends N95 for all healthcare workers at all times when they take care of H1N1 patients. Now, let me again say that the HPIC together stands on the side of the WHO and do not think it's airborne. And I have in slide 31, 23rd of July, now I do not know whether this is still on the website, but on the 23rd of July it was, the HPIC clearly recommends that based on the evidence so far, influenza do not seem to be airborne, and if you're not doing high-risk procedure, all you need is the face mask or the surgical mask. Now, in this same website document, the HPIC also mentioned a study by Beclair, which I have in slide 31 at the bottom. Now, take a look at this Beclair study. It's quite important because I have to refer to it again. Now, there is a study by Beclair that seems to suggest that influenza is airborne because they found influenza virus all over the environment. But as pointed out by HPIC, this is done by a study in the lab. This is done by a method in the lab called the PCR. And the PCR cannot differentiate between dead virus and live virus. And so, for the time being, it submits that we cannot accept the case study as it is because it is done by the PCR. In fact, today, now we know that studies that is done by the PCR has to be accepted very cautiously because really PCR is no good estimate of whether the virus is alive or not. It can be there in the environment, but is already non-viable. Now, anyway, so from slide 31, we now move to 32, and it's very clear in slide 32, the HPIC advice. Look at the first square with the yellow background. They endorse the use of surgical masks for routine care of patients with confirmed or suspected novel influenza H1N1. Okay, the N95 is only recommended when you do aerosol-generating procedures. Now, we move on to slide 33. However, the Institute of Medicine then came up with the report really around about the same time and clearly recommends the N95 because they insist that influenza is airborne. And in page 17 of the report, the basis was the study by Beclair, which I just discussed, and also another study by a professor, McIntyre, from Australia, and who shows or seems to suggest that surgical mask is inferior to the N95 in the control of influenza. So based on these two studies, the Institute of Medicine recommends that influenza is airborne and the N95 should be used. Now, it should be kept in mind that there is already another study, slide 34, by Mark Leop, that shows that there is no difference between surgical masks and N95. However, this study is not quoted or used at all in the Institute of Medicine study. Now, what is interesting is in slide 35, because in a conference in Florida, Professor McIntyre withdrew the study, retracted the study, and so really this article just says that the CDC flu mask decision based on a flawed study. This is in the news. Now, of course, it's in it's a debate whether this is so, but still, nevertheless, let me move on to slide 36. Based on this, in slide 36 is a letter produced by Shea, by IDSA, and by APIC to President Obama that the U.S. policy should be reviewed and that it is questionable whether the N95 should be used for H1N1 pandemic. Now, if you do not find what I just discussed interesting or very complicated, I understand, all right? It doesn't matter. If you find it kind of confusing, just join me again. Switch yourself back on. Because basically, slide 37 shows you that in 2010, after the pandemic, the CDC now really joined all of us. Now, previously, the WHO says you don't need the N95 for usual procedures. And the CDC says no. Now, there is really general consensus. Because in 2010, as I show in slide 37, the CDC then come along and agree that for general procedure, as I underline in red, the face mask and the surgical mask is sufficient. And the N95 for higher levels is only needed for risky procedures such as aerosol-generating procedures, all right? Now, the reason why I discuss all this is because it is advertised in the title, and some of you may be interested. But now let's move on back to the ARD document and finish the rest, all right? Now that the controversy is already discussed. Okay, now we come to point number four. Now, this is really in line with figure one. And as I said in figure one of the ARD guideline is before the diagnosis is made. Patient walks into a hospital and he only has ILI. Now, then you go to figure one. And now let's look at figure one, which is in slide 39. So as you can see in this figure, it shows very clearly that the patient comes in and the patient has ILI. Then you should triage, as shown in the square. You should triage. Those with ILI should practice what is in the box shown on the right. Now, it's very simple, actually. If you look at the box on the right, basically, what you need to do is to make sure that if the patient has ILI and comes into the hospital, whether you are at the A&E or emergency department or outpatient, or whether you are in the hospital, in the wards, just try your best to make sure that the patient are separated from one another by 1 meter, all right, or 3 feet. So look at slide 40. In A&E, you quickly provide them medical and surgical masks because of cough etiquette, and then put the ILI together, making sure that the ILI are separated from the non-ILIs in the A&E by at least 1 meter. Now, if they are in the hospital, as shown in this table, you try your very best to make sure that the patients are separated from one another by 1 meter. Now, in Hong Kong, what we do is we start what we call ARD cubicle in almost all of our acute hospitals. So that if the patient comes in with ILI, they then go to these cubicles because all these beds are separated clearly by 1 meter. All right? Now, so again, in table 42 is just a flow chart showing you. In table 41 is A&E. You triage and you direct them to the right segregated area. In table 42 is the wards. You put them into, as I said, area in the hospital where the beds are separated by 1 meter. And in Hong Kong, we call these cubicles ARD cubicles. Now, just a note on the chronic obstructive airway disease. As you know, many of these patients cough. But in general, it doesn't mean just because they cough or have sputum, because it could be a re-exacerbation. And many of these exacerbations are not caused by virus, but are by bacteria. So at least in Hong Kong, we don't include them generally into our flow chart, unless clearly they have symptoms, point number four, unless clearly they have features of coryza, sore throat, or simply put, IOI, then we include them into the flow chart. In fact, most of the time, they don't need to be included in. All right? So now to slide 44, just to mention that COAD are not included unless clear evidence of upper respiratory tract infection. All right? Now we move to slide 45. Now, if you refer back to figure 1, it says that whenever possible, pediatric patients should be isolated immediately once they go into the hospital. Now, just to say, for adult patients, we just want to make sure they are separated by about 1 meter. But in the ARD guideline, it mentions that for children, it's best you isolate them right away. Now, how can you do that? Well, just to go to point number 5, we take special measures for pediatric patients. Now, this is the special measures. And in Hong Kong, we do that. In some hospitals, maybe not all, or some hospitals for sure. We, in our pediatric units, we already have beds that are 1 meter apart. The patients are not to leave their bed without permission. We don't share essential medical equipment. Patient records are not placed by the bedside. There's no common play area. And once the diagnosis is made, of course, we try to give them the relevant isolation. But actually, if you have a ward like this, a pediatric respiratory disease isolation ward, and if you can be sure that they don't leave their beds without permission, and that the visitors behave themselves and follow rules, even after you get a diagnosis, they can remain there. Now, let me show you some pictures that we have in Hong Kong in which we practice this. So as you can see, there you are. These are the beds, the pediatric beds, in which they are not allowed to leave their beds. And the beds are clearly 3 feet apart. Now, then the next slide shows individual equipment like stethoscope for each patient is at the bedside so that they don't share. Now, very important, take a look at this picture. The patient's notes are not there. Just those papers you see on the box are just record of their vital functions. So where are the patient's notes? Well, this is the door with the alcohol hand wrap. You go outside of the door of the ward, this is where the patient's notes are in slide 50. It's the clean zone. So therefore, the doctors, after seeing the patient, will have to come out of the room, do hand hygiene, remove any protective equipment or gowns, then record it in the notes to make sure that the individual patient's files are not contaminated. As I said, visitors policies are important. So this is it in slide 51. And all information, both for patients, staff, and visitors, should be clearly posted on the door and in the wards, as shown here. All right. Now, let's then go back to figure 1. So as you can see, for triage, on the first box, we then do that box on the right, which basically means, as I said, making sure patients are separate by 1 meter. And then we move on to the next square. Now, before we move on, we separate patients by 1 meter, but as you can see in the second arrow, on figure one, in the box on the right, we already say pediatric patient with clinical symptoms should be isolated right away. And the way we do it is as I've shown you in the previous few slides. Now we look at slide 53, and the next thing is, after we know that they have IOI, we should look for clinical and epidemiological clues. And basically, these are clues that tell us whether they have severe disease. And if they have, we will try our best not just to separate them by 1 meter, but to put them into isolation rooms. Okay? Now, the clues are given in slide 54. Take a look at it. Basically, it just means that after seeing the patient, especially from the clinical history, they have produced a cluster. Or from epidemiological history, they come from a region where there is this new disease, or they work in a certain occupation or have history of contact with a known cluster. And if these epidemiological clues are present, then as shown in figure 1 or slide 53, we activate box number 2 on the right hand. Basically, it just means, yes, we use PPE, but we try our best to put them into airborne precaution room or negative pressure room. Now, but we also say here in the box, if it's not possible, then cohort patients that have the same clinical and epidemiological clues. For instance, if you have a patient coming in and he belongs to the same cluster, or he really traveled together from a region, and they have this disease that you have no diagnosis and you're not sure, it's best to put them into a negative pressure room, single room, but if not available, then put them together. But do not mix them up with other patients. All right? Now, once we finish with the epidemiological clues, we then move on, as you can see, if you look at the box on the right of figure 1, okay, in slide 53, go to slide 53, there's this big box on the top, figure 1, then the second box, which is after we have done the EPI and the ARD, the epidemiological and the clinical clues. Now, then you take a look. The next two arrows says you now have a diagnosis. Once you have a diagnosis, you go to table 1. All right? Now, so again, quickly summarize. We triage. We look for clues. But we wait, and once we have the diagnosis, we go to table 1. Table 1 is shown in slide 55. But let's go to slide 56. After diagnosis, as point number 6 says, we go to table 1. Now, we don't have much time to discuss table 1. I think the red square is a bit shifted in the slide because as we transmit through the electronic, it shifts. But basically, that red square in table 1 should cover. Now, take a look at this table 1. It put there, when do you use particulate respirator? Look at the precaution column. Particulate respirator, that is the N95. When do you use it? You basically use it for aerosol generating procedures. But you also use negative pressure room. Now, so the red square that I put on the right last hand column, it really should be covered from the yes for the particulate respirator down to the airborne negative pressure room. So let me summarize. Only when you have a novel organism that you have no diagnosis, if you have this cluster of a new disease, unknown, you should put them in an airborne precaution room, a negative pressure room, and then wear N95 all the time when you take care of the patient. Otherwise, take a look at the column. Even for SARS, even for a new influenza virus strain, even for pandemic, as you can see here, you do not routinely need the airborne precaution room, and you need the N95 only for aerosol generating procedures. Now, I hope those few points will help you, but do study the table carefully on your own and draw your own conclusions. Now, we have to move on to slide 58. Well, sometimes it's quite confusing. There are so many points, you know, I've discussed it. To be honest, sometimes I myself get confused. So, if you want to make it simple, you sort of, as I say here, fix the procedure. And these are some of the tips we can help you. Whenever possible, cohorts. That means put patients together with the same diagnosis. And if you can house all patients in a single room, that will be helpful. But most of us don't have those resources. So arrow number three, if insufficient single room, separate at least 1 meter from one another. And as I say, in Hong Kong, we start this what we call ARD cubicle. And in the ARD cubicle, we don't share equipment, and we make sure that there is good cleaning regularly of those rooms. For pediatric patients, as I already mentioned, we have special procedures. Now, in fact, what I show you in slide 58 is available in the ARD guidelines. You just go to those relevant pages and you'll find it there. Now, let's move to slide 59. Now, what I want to say here is this. So, in slide 59, we put patient in ARD cubicle. Now, once we have a clear diagnosis, let's move down to those two diamonds. As you said here in the two diamond shaped box, if it's fit for discharge, yes, go home. That's the best. Now, if it's not fit for discharge, then once you have the diagnosis, as pointed out in table one, you put them into the right isolation room. But I want to let you know that usually once we have the right diagnosis, because of the lack of space, if they are already resolving, and or if their NPA is negative, if they are already resolving, we often keep them in the ARD cubicle and keep on practicing standard and droplets and contact precautions. And we have found it to work pretty well in Hong Kong, all right? Of course, if they are getting more and more severe and serious, then you should put them into the proper single room, isolation room, or only cohort them with patients with the same diagnosis. Now, okay, we now move on to handling high-risk procedures. Now, as I said, now back to opportunistic airborne. In opportunistic airborne, it is not airborne unless it is high-risk procedures. And to show you, this is in Table 6 of the ARD guideline. Now, in this table, it shows you what are the high-risk procedures. And basically, it's intubation, bronchoscopy, and doing autopsy. Now, Table 62 actually is a bit misplaced. It should come after slide 63. So take a look at slide 63 first. Because in slide 63 now, for the final part of this lecture, this is the closing part, we just want to quickly discuss the WHO influenza guideline. Now, so quickly, if you look at slide 63, is the influenza WHO guideline. So for the WHO pandemic, first of all, we mentioned that for influenza, as already discussed, all you need is standard and droplets precaution. All right? Now then, moving on to slide 64. However, when you are doing high-risk aerosol-generating procedures, as mentioned here, you should then go on to slide 65, put on your gown, wear your N95, your glove, and have the right environment, which just entails 6 to 12 air change per hour. Now, we have no time, but study the WHO guideline carefully, and you'll be very clear. Now, for slide 66, I just put down for you both from the WHO and the CDC, what are the different high-risk aerosol generating procedures? Basically, it's about the same. It's when you enter the lung and you go below the larynx, mainly it's intubation, bronchoscopy, and autopsies. And I also have a slide in 67 just to explain to you, because outside of America, we may not know what sputum induction is. We seldom do it. So I put in a slide just to explain that. Now, slide 68 is quite important, because in slide 68, in the WHO guideline, under the in the last two box, we mentioned non-invasive ventilation and nebulization. Now, let me say clearly now that in the WHO guideline and in the ARD document, NIV and nebulization is not considered high-risk aerosol-generating procedures. And all you need is standard and droplet precaution. Now, I have no time to review with you the literature, but for slide 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, and 74, it's just a summary of the relevant literature that shows that NIV and nebulization is not, let me repeat, these are not high-risk aerosol-generating procedures. Now, just very quickly, perhaps, just to point to you in slide 69 and 70. You see, there is this SARS case in one of our public hospitals that seems to suggest that it is due to a nebulizer. But as pointed out in slide 70, a very well-done study by Dr. Wong has shown that there is no evidence it is related to nebulization. And you should take a very careful look at it. Now, we have no time, so very quickly we go on to the end. Now, first of all, let me deal with point 9 and 10 first. Use of PPE and infection control in special situations. So just quickly to refer to you, that if you want to prepare, be well prepared for the pandemic, just to let you know that in the WHO guideline in page 73, slide 78, there is a model for you to calculate the number of PPE that you need. And also, in slide 79, many, many details, waste management, etc., is also dealt with in the ARD guideline. So please refer to it. Now, isolation room. So very important. If it's airborne, you need negative pressure room. But what if you don't have enough? Now, slide 88 and 82 put down the criteria for negative pressure room. So with this, very quickly I close. However, in the ARD document, we show that natural ventilation, if you open the windows, is really very effective. Take a look at slide 83. Now, just enough time to look at the first box on the left. It's very simple. Risk is the risk of being infected. On the x-axis is the ventilation rate. And on the other x-axis is the quantum of bacteria. Now take a look. No matter how heavy the quantum of bacteria, when your ventilation rate reach somewhere in 15, take a look at 10 and 20 and 15, your risk really dropped down to zero. So, all you really need is 15 and above air change. Now, slide 84 is just a study we have done in Hong Kong showing you that when you open the windows, even when your doors are closed, you easily reach 15 air change per hour. And that is why in the old days, slide 85 is just for an example, many of our TB sanatorium or hospitals, we just open the windows. And slide 86 is another study done in Peru that shows the same conclusion. Slide 87 really shows you that when you open the windows, the concentration of bacteria drops straight away. So really it's very safe. And slide 88, it just shows you that when you compare our TB hospital, one TB hospital, the staff health care workers that are infected is really the same. All right? Now, I really must close. So very quickly, slide 89 and 90, just to show you that in Hong Kong, we have got a study that is going to come out in the CID soon. I think in about 2 weeks' time, the next issue of the CID will be published, in which we show that in Hong Kong, the non-clinical staff and the clinical staff who are infected in the recent pandemic come out to be exactly the same. Now, the non-clinical staff do not see patients. The clinical staff sees patients. So with good infection control, really, you know, it comes to the same. Let me just close with slide 91. In fact, I gave a talk somewhere in the United States, and there is this letter I received in an email saying that really they believe that if you open the windows, it works. So really, colleagues from all over the world, if your country cannot afford negative pressure room, go to the ARD cubicle, ARD document, go to the relevant chapter. We have given enough advice how you can then use natural ventilation. Just open the windows. And in fact, there's another document in the CDC, in the WHO website that gives even more detail under natural ventilation. You just type in natural ventilation, search for it, and you will find it. So colleagues, let me close. Just open your windows. You know, even for airborne infection, you will be adequately protected. But of course, let me say that when you open your windows, you have to open the right windows, not Microsoft Windows. Huh? Make sure you open the windows and let the air come in. Okay, I'll close with this. Have a good day, and thank you very much.
And thank you, Professor Seto, for that excellent presentation. It's certainly been very insightful, and I imagine many of us now will be going to the WHO website and downloading those guidelines. I think we're really pressed for time, so once again, on behalf of everybody who has been listening to the presentation, we thank you very much, and thank you to everybody also who has joined in and listened. At that, I will close this teleclass. Many thanks, everybody.
Okay, thank you.